morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Since 2005, when Congress passed a federal mandate to blend corn-based ethanol and other renewable fuels into conventional gasoline, the increased demand for corn, which has supplied nearly all these mandated fuels to date, has resulted in a major transformation of the landscape. Farmers hoping to take advantage of rising prices for corn and other commodity crops converted more than 7 million acres of native prairie, rangeland, wetlands, and forests into cropland. This act, which was supposed to curb carbon emissions and encourage renewable energy resources, has instead encouraged farmers to clear land, drain wetlands, and apply more fertilizers, pesticides, and irrigation water to maximize their production. This morning, we talk with National Wildlife Federation President Colin O'Mara about the NWF's new report, Fueling Destruction, which brings to light the unintended consequences of requiring the use of corn-based fuels. Colin, welcome to Locus Focus.
Barbara, thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm going to throw a kind of curve at you, because before we start talking about what is a very important subject, I feel like everything that's going on in my mind right now is kind of in the context of like watching the rise of fascism in this country and how I think we're all becoming endangered species, like the ones you report describe in the report. And I just feel like I just wanted to make a comment and maybe get your feelings about what's going on in airports around the country right now and how you see yourself in terms of doing the environmental work that you do when you recognize this crackdown on immigrants and Muslims and people that are deemed, unnecessary and dangerous by our current president.
No, I stand with the protesters and was engaged this weekend. I mean, I come from as my name would suggest, I come from a long line of Irish immigrants who, you know, came because of the famine that was, you know, going on in the 1850s. My wife, her family immigrated in the 1980s to avoid the coming civil war in Sri Lanka. And you know, in both cases, there were some that were concerned about, you know, the kind of some more extreme elements in those populations that, with a similar kind of reactionary policy at the time, neither one of our families would have been here. So, you know, I think the challenge that I continue to see is how do we turn this incredible energy that we're seeing, whether it's the Women's March or the protests over the weekend, into actual policy action. Because the protests are good, but it's really going to come down to fights at the courts or fights in Congress or having, you know, elected officials stand up and say, you know, these are not American values. But I mean, I'm inspired by the action. I think now that we need to make sure it turns into real results for people, because I'm not convinced, based on anything we've seen in the last several months, that the administration is going to step down from the actions they took during the campaign and the actions in their first week. I think it's going to take, you know, other kind of good actors to overcome the assault on some basic values, particularly when the data is so clear and that, you know, it's going to make us less safe abroad. It's not actually targeting the countries where we've actually had, you know, kind of attacks from. And frankly, it again characterizes an entire religion that is based on a principle of peace as harboring terror, even though it's limited to a small number of the total Muslim population. So, you know, I'm with you on your initial comments.
Yeah, and also interestingly, Trump did not target majority Muslim countries where he has major real estate holdings and business dealings, like Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, and Pakistan. So there it speaks, I think, a whole lot as well. And I guess one other thing is, I'll speak as a second generation Jew in this country, that it was rather shocking to me that he made this declaration basically banning Muslims from coming to the country on the anniversary of the Holocaust and the Holocaust Memorial. And in his mention of Holocaust Memorial Day, he didn't mention Jews. And kind of later, in response to it, he said, well, there were a lot of other groups of people that were murdered besides the Jews, so let's not bring up the Jews. And to me, that speaks volumes about how they're seeing Muslims now and the way that you can just disregard whole communities and groups of people.
Well, and I think that's going to be one of the biggest challenges is that, you know, I mean, and I believe that over 240 years, you know, we have proven kind of beyond any shadow of a doubt that inclusion is our strength, and that, you know, people don't move to America. You know, people make America when they come here. And, you know, I mean, I think the complete disregard for the history of the Holocaust, the way the statement was written. And, you know, again, that's not to disregard the, you know, the Gypsy populations or the Catholics or others, but I mean, it was an explicit assault on the Jewish faith. and the Jewish people. And I think the challenge is how do we have these different voices again, you know, kind of rise up in a constructive way that's actually enacting change, because this is a fight that's going to take the long haul. I mean, this is potentially years of these kind of sustained efforts. But I again agree with your with the concerns.
Well, and one last thing, because we think of ourselves as a country of laws, and as I was reading your report, it was interesting to be reading the report over the weekend as all these outrageous things were coming down from the Trump administration, and thinking. You in the report, you're suggesting legislative measures that are going to be taken to try to correct the problems that you see with the ethanol mandate. And I'm thinking, do we have a country of laws? Especially, I was really heartened Saturday to find that the judges were starting to put injunctions in place against some of the parts of this order that Trump came down with. However, it seemed like the Trump administration is not listening to the judges, and that makes me really concerned. Do you see that we are at the brink of actually no longer being a nation of laws, and that we're going to have to find some other means to confront this administration and their basically fascistic intent when they aren't even going to listen to judges?
I mean, I think the rhetoric is concerning, right? When someone disparages the opinion of a district court judge because of the president they were appointed by, we haven't seen that in our history. I mean, there have been massive disagreements in the last few years over healthcare, over different things, and folks would point out that this was a conservative judge appointed by a Republican president, or a Democratic judge, or a liberal judge appointed by a Democratic president. But I mean, I can't remember a single official from either party suggesting that a decision not be upheld because of who the judge was appointed by. And we heard that yesterday from administration officials. So I mean, it is funny because we actually scheduled this interview before the events of the past week. And my concern is not just simply a kind of disregard for laws and using the healthcare. You start using the immigration example. I mean, there are laws on the books going back to the 50s and 60s that make it expressly prohibited to do what the administration tried to do per executive order. It's also an assault on basic science and just basic facts. And one of my heroes is an old senator from New York, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who I had a chance to meet when I was younger. He used to always talk about as one of his core principles that everyone's entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. And we're entering a reality now where either laws or court decisions that are disagreed with may be just summarily ignored until some other kind of shock to the system requires them to be acknowledged. And I think that's a scary place. And on the conservation side, the assault on sound science and the assault on scientists and kind of the questioning of long settled science is all equally disturbing. I mean, maybe to a lesser degree as some of these other assaults on basic constitutional liberties, but the same thing. I mean, it is this kind of alternative reality that we're figuring out how to operate during.
And all these alternative facts, right, which are kind of disconcerting. Actually, one of the things that's been heartening to me is the way that scientists are rising up, and they're not rising up in a partisan way. They're rising up in defense of science. And I saw a poster, I think, online today, or placard, and it was like, what do we want? Objective science and how do we get it through peer review? It's a typical scientist poster.
A little nerdy, but yeah, as someone who spent a lot of years in academia, I respect that. And from my point of view, I think the biggest challenge that we face is actually making sure these kind of objective truths are put out there. And I firmly believe that. You cannot be pro-outdoors, you cannot be pro-outdoor economy, pro-hunting, fishing, birding, camping, hiking, canoeing, whatever, if you're not pro-science. I mean, we have made incredible progress over the past century because we've had sound science be the foundation of things like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. Going back before that to the way we fund and manage wildlife populations being based on science, not based on politics. And if you erode that, if you chip away at it, you really have no kind of objective reality to be making decisions based upon. And I think that's what you're seeing these scientists rise up to. And a good friend of mine runs the Union of Concerned Scientists, and he's saying that he's hearing folks from academia wanting to get engaged at rates never seen before because they view their life's work and the research they try to bring to try to shape a better, kind of a more perfect union being under assault right now. So I'm encouraged, again, how we actually turn that energy into action, I think, is the thing we must be focused on.
So are you going to go to the Scientist March on Washington whenever it is actually scheduled?
Yeah, I mean, we'll be engaged. I mean, and this is the thing, National Holiday Federation, we're a completely bipartisan organization. I mean, there's no Republican red tails, you know, red or smallmouth bass, or a Democratic, white-tailed deer. I mean, like, we are about half my members are Republicans, about half are Democrats. I got conservatives and liberals and, you know, everything in between. And, you know, I mean, science is science. And the one thing they can agree on, they might not agree on anything else on the domestic policy landscape, but they can all agree they want healthy natural resources, they want abundant wildlife populations, they want science-driving decision-making. And I don't care if you're talking to the most conservative Tea Party member, the most liberal, you know, progressive, that the folks that love the outdoors want science to matter. And I think that's what you're going to see, you know, great support for the amazing scientists we have across the country, not to mention some of whom are immigrants, many of whom are immigrants. I think these worlds are going to come together in a way that shows that, you know, America is best when we're kind of upholding our values, and that's everything from inclusion to kind of scientific facts underpinning decision making.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Colin O'Mara of Irish extraction, who is the president of the National Wildlife Federation and a descendant of immigrants, just like most of us here, or just about all of us. And we're going to be actually talking this morning about a report that the National Wildlife Federation put out called Fueling Destruction, the Unintended Consequences of the Renewable Fuel Standard on Land, Water, and Wildlife. Now, interestingly, the ethanol mandate that you talk about, which you see as kind of misguided mandate that maybe had good intentions but really unintended consequences, it came out and it was actually put into a really effect during the Obama administration. I'm actually trying to remember what year it came out, whether it was 2009 or 2007.
Yeah, so it was actually originally part of an energy package during the Bush administration during 2005, and then it was made kind of more aggressive in 2007 during a fairly bipartisan debate. And the theory was fairly simple, that if you increase use of biofuels, you'll create some jobs in some parts of the country that were struggling, and that you'll reduce dependence on foreign oil, and that you should reduce emissions a lot, because the assumption was that the cleaner sources of that the biofuels would be a cleaner source of fuel. And looking, you know, kind of back, almost 10 years later now, there were commitments that were made around not having any additional land cleared, that we're not going to have any adverse environmental impact, there wouldn't be any economic impact. And, you know, I think one of the challenges is that when government starts intervening in these markets without fully understanding the consequences, there are some perverse unintended consequences. And what we've seen now, you know, 10 years later, is that we've lost, you know, millions of acres of habitat, and particularly some very important grasslands, wetlands, and forests, that the science is very unclear about whether it actually reduces emissions or not, because the amount of energy it takes to extract the fuel from the corn ethanol process is much greater than people anticipated in the advanced biofuels, which have huge promise for the future of the country and reducing, you know, climate greenhouse gas emissions and reducing particulate pollution, haven't really kind of come online at the same speed, frankly, because we've been over subsidizing and over mandating the use of the last generation fuels. And so, you know, we kind of met the enemy, and, you know, he is us in this case, because, you know, we created a policy that basically locked us into a environmentally damaging policy and didn't give us the benefits of the next generation fuels, which are going to be an important part of reducing emissions to achieve the climate goals that we need to in the coming years and decades ahead.
Well, in your report, you don't mention something that I recall. I mean, really, it was one of the big debates when the ethanol mandate first came on. And that had to do with, first of all, why corn as opposed to cellulosic biofuels. It seemed to be a lot of lobbying on the part of farmers in the Midwest or the farm states that were already corn growers to emphasize the role of corn ethanol, and to kind of downplay the other kinds of ethanol that were possible. And I know this is an issue when Barack Obama was running for president, coming from a corn growing state, Illinois, he was a big supporter of the ethanol mandate. And so how did that politics shape in, and is that, did that have anything to do with some of the other much more viable, actually, methods of producing biofuels, that they got short shrift and corn became king?
Yeah, you remembered it extremely well. I mean, the fight that a lot of folks on both the left and the right from non-corn growing states was that let's focus on advanced biofuels, things that are not going to distort food prices, that have much better environmental impact, that require much less land clearing. And the lobby for corn was very strong. And at the time, the economy wasn't that strong. You know, there was still kind of recovering from the recession at the early part of that decade. And so a big focus and a big part of the mandate for several years, well, more than half, 70-80% of it, was focused on kind of last generation corn ethanol. And obviously there's a presidential touch point because, you know, a lot of candidates, as they try to garner favor for the Iowa caucuses, they pledge their fidelity to ethanol. And what happened was rather than seizing on the technological advances that were really going incredibly at that time, and you saw a lot of investment from places like Silicon Valley and a lot of great research and universities and places like Portland, Seattle, and others, I mean, places that are kind of tech centers, saw a lot of innovation in this area. You saw a lot of that come to a halt because all the easy money was to basically just build out corn production, build facilities that were not particularly efficient, that had a lot of emissions, as a way to meet the mandate in the cheapest form because it was, you know, kind of existing crops. And so you saw a lot of the next generation technologies, you saw the advancement of them slow down over time. And it's really heartbreaking because the time that we've lost is actually, you know, the very time that it, you know, the decade that we lost is the time that if we had focused on it, we actually could be at scale right now with cellulosic. And cellulosic is primarily coming from byproducts, kind of the non-food stuff. Part of whether it's corn or other crops, and we've seen other countries move ahead with other types of biofuels, kind of in research phases like algae and other things. That again, we're not seeing the same level of investment here because we have this incumbent industry that we've created with last generation corn that is really crowding out investment in other sectors.
We have an auto mechanic who was very interested in coming up with alternative fuels, and he was going to build an ethanol distiller in his backyard, basically, and he wanted to have it be cellulosic. He couldn't actually finance that. He wound up making a corn ethanol distillery instead, even though he knew that corn was not the really appropriate raw stock for ethanol. And this was a number of years ago, and it kind of made me a little bit uncomfortable about why was it that cellulosic and the other kinds of advanced ethanol processes didn't happen. My question is, how much did Monsanto have to do with this? Because after all, Monsanto is really big about growing corn and growing GMO corn and selling their pesticides. And it seems like there's a whole corn loop that was very hard to break out of.
Yeah, and I think it's not just any single company. I think you have a whole bunch of corporate interests that are benefit from this. I mean, most of the corn that is used to comply is coming from the big guys. This isn't coming from the small family farms. I mean, a lot of their corn may go into this market, but most of it's going for other uses. And I think it's just kind of a perfect storm. I mean, it's hard when you have big incumbent industries that have huge lobbying power, in addition to, in this case, huge political power with the caucus and just kind of the number of senators that represent parts of the Corn Belt to have, you know, kind of the last generation, kind of the suboptimal outcome kind of be invested in as opposed to the next generation technology where, you know, there weren't that many folks at the time that were working in cellulosic because it was a nascent technology. You know, this is one of the challenges with, you know, kind of when government picks winners and losers in markets, we tend to pick wrong because we tend to pick industries that have the loudest voice or have, you know, kind of the representatives that have their interests in mind as, you know, because their constituencies or various companies in their districts. And so we end up unintentionally kind of subsidizing the past instead of focusing on the future. We see the same fight, you know, in some of the climate debates with renewable energy, right? I mean, it's always a fight over extending renewable energy credits because up until the Obama administration, there hadn't been that many jobs associated with them as the technology for growing. Now we have hundreds of thousands of people employed in clean energy, so there's a bigger and bigger voice there. But, you know, you see subsidies for incumbent industries and oil and gas as examples that are the billions of dollars that are there that when new technologies are trying to compete with them, you know, there's a powerful voice crowding out that type of new investment. So, you know, I mean, unfortunately, it's a pattern that kind of pops up again and again. And this is just one, not the corn ethanol is just another example of using their political might to then kind of really kind of squeeze out the future.
Well, one of the things I recall in that debate as the ethanol mandate was coming on board was the whole question about like energy in versus energy out, and that in fact it was going to take at least as much energy to produce corn ethanol as you were going to get out of it. In fact, I think it was maybe a negative net gain.
Yeah, and there's studies on both sides. So there's studies that show that there's a small air quality gain. There's just a study put up by the United States Department of Agriculture that suggests that it's better for clean air. There's some pretty rosy assumptions in that report, and there's other reports done by top universities that show that it's a huge net loss, that you have a lot more energy is needed to go in. The fact that the science is so inconclusive shows that it's not a home run. I mean, it's not a slam dunk, or I'm not sure what the sports analogies I can use, but that it's obviously not clear. And that was the primary purpose, that and reducing the dependence on foreign oil. And what we've seen in the intervening years with the explosion of the kind of fracking technology, the fracking technologies, and the kind of the development of the Dakotas and the Bakken reserves and some of the reserves in Canada, is that what is done more than anything is not actually displaced foreign oil. It's just allowed a slightly more oil and gas to be exported, more gas and more oil in particular to be exported. So it actually didn't. We're already pretty close to energy independence if you kind of look at the total amount that we're producing right now compared to what we're importing. And so it actually didn't achieve. So it didn't achieve the environmental side. It didn't really achieve the economic, national security side. And then the employment side, I think, is also mixed. So,
well, another thing that was argued against ethanol back in the earlier part of the century was that it was going to reduce the amount of land available for growing crops, and that why do you want to grow crops that are food crops that are going to go feed our cars as opposed to feeding us? In your report, I mean, you touch on that, but it seems like instead of just reducing the amount of land that was being dedicated for growing food crops, instead it's expanded farming on lands that perhaps shouldn't or definitely shouldn't be farmed. So let's talk a little bit about what that impact was and how it's having a much greater impact on not just what humans get to eat, but what the rest of nature gets to eat in this country.
Yeah, no, thank you for the question, because I think this is probably the most underreported part of kind of the impacts of this particular policy. There was a piece of language in the law that when it passed about not having any impact in any lands that were not in production prior to 2007. And there's kind of commitments that were made, and there are a whole bunch of Republicans and Democrats that stood together that wanted that language to make sure that we weren't going to basically plow under or kind of cut through important habitat as a need to meet this demand. In 2007, only 9% of all the corn that was grown in the country went to any kind of fuel. A lot of those were like oxygenate. This is when folks are trying to figure out ways to kind of clean up gasoline after the MBT problems of the 90s. And today that number is 40%. So you've gone from 9% to 40% in the amount of corn that's grown for ethanol. You've seen the amount of corn and soy and other crops kind of go up a lot in the last few years. And a lot of that's due to this mandate. There's some due to exports around the globe. But the biggest number increases are in corn and soy for diesel. And what we're seeing is that because the price supports are so high because of the way the markets work, and where there's these credits that have to be bought by the refiners as a way to kind of satisfy their obligations under the law, that they artificially jacked up prices pretty dramatically. And so before the law, ethanol prices might be, corn prices might be, $2-3 a bushel, which for marginal lands, for lands that aren't that productive, by the time you have to apply fertilizers and maybe do some irrigation, it's not profitable to have crops on those lands. When this mandate goes into place, all of a sudden corn prices jump to like $7 or $8 a bushel. At which point, that farm, that field that maybe was a little rockier, or maybe the soils just weren't as good, and there are other challenges. All of a sudden, you can afford to put on a lot of fertilizer and put on a lot of irrigation to try to make the land work. And so you start seeing corn grown in places that you never saw before, places like in Idaho, places like in like eastern Montana, places in the Great Lakes region that had never seen the density of corn that they're seeing, places like along like Lake Erie, places that you wouldn't expect outside of the Iowa, Nebraska, the Dakotas. And what happens is over the next years, the University of Wisconsin estimates that more than 7 million acres of land was lost related to this policy and other changes. And that's a lot of habitat. And it's not just you know, it's not just the grasslands that are lost or the wetlands or the forests. It's the species that count on that kind of land. And one thing we've become very good at in this country is basically killing everything except for the single crop that we're trying to grow on an individual acre. And so the milkweed that was on the corners of you know, the on the buffers around different acreage that supported monarchs and or the bee balm or the, you know, different pollinating plants that support, you know, native bees that are important for pollination, or, you know, the seed plants that supported things like meadowlarks or you know, pheasants or other types of birds. You saw habitat from ducks being lost, from different kinds of waterfowl. You saw things like swift fox losing their habitat. And you see these populations of all these species that depend on these amazing grasslands plummet during this period. And again, it's not entirely because of this policy, but when you take out 7 million acres, you know, which is, you know, six times the size of my home state of Delaware, I mean, it's a lot of land, and it's a lot of habitat for a lot of species that, frankly, we need to be part of a healthy ecosystem. And this is where we just don't understand the consequences of our actions a lot. Where if somebody said, hey, we're going to pass a policy that's going to decimate pollinator populations, I think people would have had a second before, you know, trying to advance such a thing. These debates weren't even had outside of a few groups like ours that were trying to raise things. Hey, if you lose that kind of habitat at that kind of scale, you're going to have problems. And I think now we're seeing the consequences.
Well, if we're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with National Wildlife Federation President Colin O'Meara. We're talking about their report, Fueling Destruction, which brings to light the unintended consequences of requiring the use of corn-based fuels as part of the renewable fuel mandate that was passed in 2007. Besides the destruction of wildlife habitat, it seems like this is also having an impact on human habitat as well. And let's talk about the impacts of the runoff from irrigated and highly pesticided and fertilized cropland into our waterways.
This is another part of the untold story. You know, we've seen massive algal blooms emerge in the last few years, bigger than anything you've seen since the, you know, 60s and 70s before the Clean Water Act. And I'll use an example from Michigan and from Ohio. In the western basin of Lake Erie, we've seen these massive algal blooms, bigger than anything else. And then Lake Erie, and that place is actually the most shallow part of the Great Lakes. It's as little as 40 feet at some of its depth. And we've seen these massive algal blooms that are getting worse and worse. And scientists from the University of Michigan and Ohio State and others were trying to figure out what the source was. And as they got into the science, it turned out that a whole lot more land was going into crop production for corn specifically, marginal lands, again, that needed a lot of fertilizer to be put on them, a lot of nutrients to be applied to make the land productive. And what was happening is that they're applying everything from like manure, they're applying, you know, different types of nitrogen or phosphorus onto the land at huge quantities to try to make the lands productive. And then anytime there's a heavy rain or a thaw, a lot of that water would basically wipe the nutrients off the land and put it into the water column. And then when the water warmed up a little bit over the summer, you get these massive algal blooms. And there's one story, and you may recall from 3 years ago, or 2.5 years ago, when the city of Toledo couldn't drink their drinking water for 3 days because of this microcystin toxin as part of this algal bloom that basically just decimated their drinking water quality and made it toxic. And you couldn't bathe it with it. You couldn't cook with it. It was actually so toxic you couldn't actually boil it away. You actually had to use bottled water for those days. And so we're seeing these secondary impacts because we're growing crops in areas we've never grown before, because we're growing crops in areas that need a lot more nutrients. If those nutrients don't stay in the landscape, if they're not taken up by the crops, they wind up in the water, we have all these secondary problems. And you're seeing the same thing in the upper Mississippi. You're seeing the same thing in parts of the Missouri, some issues in the Ohio River Valley. And so, again, we're trying to connect these dots, saying, you know, this is, again, a government-created crisis. And, again, this isn't the farmers' fault. I mean, the farmers are rationally responding to a bad government policy. And you know, we think then that's part of the solution is actually finding ways to have them be incented to do more in conservation and kind of less in this kind of more harmful production. But, you know, again, it's an unintended consequence. So now we'll spend millions of dollars trying to clean up Lake Erie and these other water bodies, trying to remove these nutrients that government actually was the catalyst for them being entered into the waterway in the first place.
Well, what... what are some of the ways that we can address correcting this problem. And I sort of, as I was reading your proposed solutions in your report last night, in the midst of chaos in airports and thinking about there's no government rules anymore except these strange ones you can't understand, how do you propose addressing these problems, a lot of them which really came into play during the Obama administration, with an administration that is hell-bent on just doing away with all environmental regulation now?
Right. And again, this is where a rational conversation about science would be a much easier starting place. And I think, you know, President Obama is going to go down as one of the presidents with one of the strongest environmental legacies. I mean, I think it'll be up there with you know, people like Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt, and even President Nixon, who oversaw the creation of the EPA and the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, despite other transgressions.
No, he vetoed. Didn't he veto the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and the veto was overridden by one of the most liberal Congresses we ever had?
So he vetoed the Clean Water Act, and actually this is a misunderstood story. So he vetoed the Clean Water Act, not because of the regulatory side, because he was concerned that the state revolving fund, the infrastructure fund that's part of the act, was too expensive for the budget. And so it wasn't a concern about the regulatory side. It was about the financial side of basically how much money should the feds be putting into state local water and sewer systems, as opposed to the feds versus the state share. It was really that question. And so, yes, it was overturned completely. And so he did veto it the first time, but it wasn't blanket opposition because of folks like Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Bill Ruckelhaus and others that were in his team that were really great environmental champions. So there's plenty of other things to disagree with that administration about. But on this side, I mean, I think they do deserve some credit that they don't always get from progressives like us. But I think for us, it starts with trying to acknowledge that there is a problem, and there's ways in the law to try to fix it. You can reduce the volumes in the law. You can increase incentives for conservation. You can decrease the requirements for corn ethanol. There's things you can do with trying to improve incentives for advanced biofuels. And I think from my point of view, I think this is one of the blemishes on the Obama legacy. I mean, I think that he did amazing things on climate, on public lands, on you know, clean air and clean water, and obviously we're going to have to defend those as we're seeing an assault on a lot of the basic bedrock laws in the weeks and months ahead. But this is one blind spot, and I think it comes from being from a corn state and kind of winning the Iowa caucus. But there are things in the law that can happen administratively. We're going to try to do that with the administration and, you know, do everything we possibly can, but obviously this is a tough area to have agreement, and also there's commitments that the president made while he was campaigning. He said very different things about ethanol in different parts of the country. In Iowa, he said he was very supportive. When he was in New York, he said he had a lot of concerns about the markets and the way they're being abused. So we think there may be some opportunities for some common ground there. And congressionally, we think there's a lot of opportunity. And there's a lot of leadership, frankly, coming out of Oregon that's very important. Greg Walden, the conservative congressman from eastern Oregon, has been a lead champion of reform for many years. Congressman Blumenauer has also talked about the need to have more advanced biofuels, the way to fight climate. And so, again, there's folks that don't agree on much that agree that this policy has to be reformed. And so, I mean, it won't have the big splashy headlines like the fights over trade or healthcare or immigration, but it is the kind of work that, you know, when folks are kind of paying attention to other things, that, you know, serious people can kind of get together behind the scenes and actually work out compromise and reform that could make a big difference for wildlife, for water quality, for habitat. And that's what we're hoping will happen now that we've kind of put together the science and been working with leaders on both sides of the aisle to try to, you know, say that now is the time for reform. So we're hopeful, we're cautiously optimistic that this could be one area that there might be a little bit of bipartisanship, as there's kind of very aggressive battles on many other issues.
Well, interestingly, as I was preparing for this show last week, I got an email that was a link to an article in the Financial Times, and the headline is "Trump Advisor Carl Icahn Gains His Market See Biofuel Rule Change." And I guess Carl Icahn, who is one of Trump's unofficial but very powerful advisors on environmental issues, and who's the one who's behind Pruitt being nominated for the head of the EPA, he's made like doubled his value because of the drop in the what they're called the payments that refineries, the RIMs, that refineries have to pay if they don't meet the renewable fuel mandate. So I'm wondering how this plays in, because there's two sides to it. One is Carl Icahn wants to get rid of the mandate totally, and Trump maybe owes something to the Midwest that helped to elect him to keep the mandate.
You summed it up perfectly. I mean, I think that's one of the big questions. I mean, Scott Pruitt, who, you know, we actually have opposed his nomination. We've never, the National Wildlife Federation has never opposed a nomination of a cabinet official before, but his anti-science and anti-Clean Air Act, anti-Clean Water Act, anti-EPA record just does not justify him. Does not, and we think he's not qualified to be EPA administrator. One area that we did agree was that, you know, he has opposed the renewable fuel standard on some occasions, even though he's kind of walked some of those comments back as he's tried to go through confirmation. But again, and this is where they're strange bedfellows, because there's folks that, you know, we traditionally disagree with on things, you know, some folks from, you know, some of the heavy industries. When this one issue, the interests do align. And I think, you know, when you have, you know, some folks from industry and folks from the recreation economy and some of the small boating communities, and then you also have, you know, some environmental justice folks and social justice folks that are concerned about price implications and impacts on water quality for low-income communities, and then conservation groups like ours that are concerned about wildlife and water quality and habitat quality, able to come together. That in this current environment that is so polarized, that's like the one kind of perfect storm that can overcome that. And we've seen it a few times in the past few years. We saw it with chemical reform, where you had folks coming together because the system was so horribly broken. They had environmental groups and conservation groups working with industry, working with health groups to revise the Toxic Substances Control Act, which was revised a year and a half ago. And you also saw it with the Water Resources Development Act that also did a lot of things to help Flint, Michigan, and some other communities, where you saw bipartisan interests come together. So I'm hopeful that those voices, even though, you know, I'm not thrilled about the economic interests that are motivating some of them, but I mean, I do think that there's a chance for a coalition that, again, it will not be the kind of traditional right versus left. It will be much more complex than that, and it could be enough to make a big difference in the policy.
But one thing I wonder about, I mean, someone like Icahn, who really does not believe in renewable energy at all, and just wants us to be in a fossil fuel diet until we choke ourselves to death and drown in the rising oceans. But I know that you'd like to see cellulosic ethanol replace corn ethanol and other more advanced ethanol forms. Do you think that there's a possibility that would happen under this current administration?
I think if there's a chance of administrative action, because the EPA administrator actually has a lot of latitude for how to change the limits, the volume kind of requirements. If they did it that way, then there's probably not as much hope for something big with advanced biofuels. But if it's a congressional opportunity and there's congressional reform, you're going to need a lot of Democrats to pass any kind of legislation, because you'll lose some of the Midwestern and kind of prairie Republicans because of their kind of state interests. And so you're going to need a big chunk of Democrats. And if Democrats come to the negotiating table and say, you know, we are happy to support reform, but we want to see a very clear, strong future for advanced biofuels, I think they can get it. And I think this is where the deal that could come together, where we say we're going to significantly reduce the volume limits for corn ethanol, for last generation ethanol, you know, hopefully below the blend wall, and, you know, and hopefully have it at a very low level and declining over time. And then we're going to increase some opportunities for advanced biofuels. And then we're also going to increase some conservation programs as a way to mitigate the damage that's already been done in the landscape, and also not fully penalize farmers that were just kind of doing the right thing by government policy, economically at least, and making sure that I'd rather have them growing ducks and pheasants and meadowlarks and their pollinators on their property with a little more habitat work than, you know, having them have a bunch of fallow land that's completely unproductive and unused. So, I mean, there is a deal to be had there. It's just a matter of, can you get rational minds to come together in this kind of irrational time that we're in?
That's a good question, and we'll leave it at that. So I want to thank you very much for joining us, Colin. It's been great talking with you.
Barbara, thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking with Colin O'Mara, president of the National Wildlife Federation, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what we missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Clark Williams Derry, who's with Sightline Institute in Seattle, about the shaky financing for the Dakota Access Pipeline. My engineer is Daryl Crook. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. And we're going to go out with some music by Procol Harum.
First just go steep, turn the